So this community, Sangha retreat, I really appreciate those of you who've come up from Chithurst and Devon to participate in this, because this will be the last winter retreat that I'll be here. And this reflectiveness that I've, these, like morning reflections, is ways of looking or examining, reminding. So in terms of teaching and me teaching you something, or being someone who's trying to teach you Dhamma, or thinking that I know more about it than you do, or position like this is not the point. It's just reflecting from my own experience, really observing, the conditions that I experience in my mind and through this formation, this bodily formation, its senses, its habits, its tendencies. And so it's like an example or encouragement for each one of us to look at ourselves, to observe, be the observer, the knower, and to discern that difference between the object and the subject, like the personality, the sakya-ditthi, is always the object. Whatever you think you are, or believe you are, and any conditions that you identify with, the physical body, emotional habits, likes, dislikes, cultural conditioning, it's an arom, it's aramana, the Pali word aramana. It's an object in the mind. So this is a kind of, this is knowing, this is discerning from consciousness. We're all experiencing consciousness within the within individual forms. And then is consciousness individual? Or do I, the bodies are certainly separate individual forms in this space. And so this is what we call, my body, my space, my feelings, my memories, my loves and hates. My opinion, it comes from this illusion of I am the conditions, I am the aramana, I am this person, this identity. And so mindfulness, sati sampajanya, is the way the Buddha pointed to, this gate, this door, this escape from the born, the originated, created, the formed. That most human beings are blindly attached to. Why are there so many problems and wars and hatreds and desires for revenge and resentments and, among groups, the ethnic groups, tribal groups, nationalities, races, gender. Remember when in Rwanda, the Hutu and the Tutsi tribe. Now, I've never been there, but where they'd been living together, as neighbors and even intermarried, and then suddenly these identities, tribal identities, take over. And what happens is the Aramanas, we become Hutus or Tutsis, and then with that, then the emotions of resentment, jealousy, hatred, whatever arise. And yet, the same consciousness, you know, this consciousness of a Hutu, a Tutsi, of French person or an English one, German or American or Thai, Sinhalese, consciousness is not, it has no nationality. No quality, it doesn't have any quality that you can, you know, it's not yellow or red or blue, it's not good or bad, it's not right or wrong, but without it, the rest couldn't exist. Without the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. And so in this practice, of the Buddha's teaching, you know, this teaching is all about pointing, getting us to let go of this blind obsession with conditioned phenomena. To the institutionalization of ourselves, the firm beliefs in our own views, loves and likes and dislikes, and cultural biases, religious prejudices, and all the rest that are divisive, limited, and mortal, and they're the born, the originated, the created, the formed. So whatever you believe you are, think you are, whether it's good or bad or high or low, it's not what you are. You're not a thing, not an aramana, not a personality. But then this sounds like, you know, like annihilation. If I'm not any of these things, then what am I? Because this is pointing to the boundaries of thought, the thinking mind. We want to find out what we are. But this consciousness, pure awareness, brings us into pure subjectivity, impersonality, the deathless, the Mata Dhamma, the unconditioned, unborn, unoriginated, uncreated. So that's why we've been using this chant, Atti Bhikkhave Aja Dang Aputang Akatang Sankadang. Because to me this is the thing that really I've used in my monastic life. Coming across it when I was a Samanera and reading in the book, The Word of the Buddha. As you know, it was that's the only kind of reference book I had with me in my Samanera seclusion in Nongkhar. And so certain teachings kind of resonate, you know, they more than others. And this one, some people, this is meaningless, you know, I realize that. But there is the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. To me, that's a statement of great significance. It's like a Buddha's announcing, saying, you know, there is. Even within the seemingly hopeless sensory impingement and complexities of the born, the created, the formed, the conditioned. Because that's what we are as human forms, as individuals, as emotional creatures, as feeling entities, as men and women, as monks and nuns, as whatever. It's, we become complicated, neurotic. Lost in a sticky web of conditioning. It's like you're just trying to get out of it, is out of this sticky web, out of this conditioned realm, through being averse to it or wanting to annihilate it. It's like wherever you free yourself, you're stuck in another place. It's just the, you're on this, in this web that there's no escape from in terms of conditioning. There's no conditioned way you can escape from it. You're stuck onto it as a entity, as a human form, as a condition in this conditioned realm, in this planetary realm, in this sensory realm. The only possible way that you can think of getting out of it is to destroy everything, commit suicide, or blow up the universe, or whatever. You know, that's the logic of the thinking mind, the dualism, you know. Or, like modern tendencies now to make everything right, to try to refine the conditions. Get rid of the evil, annihilate the evil forces, kill the devil. Annihilate the Taliban. You know, whatever we decide is a force of evil and we want to destroy it. And that's the limitation of conditioning, isn't it? If I don't like it, I want to get rid of it. If I find something frightens me or intimidates me, I want to destroy it or run away from it. I want the security that everything's going to be okay, that the British economy will get better and better, that this economic crisis will cease, that all the problems of the society will be solved, that everybody will be happy and content, that everything will be fair and just, and everybody will be enlightened. And so that's, that, from the conditioned plane, that's, what we would like, and then what we don't like is the other. We don't like economic crashes, depressions, recessions. You know, we don't want to call this a depression, because that we remember, some of us, were born in the depression of the 1930s, which was, I don't remember it. I was so young then, but my parents were permanently affected by that. The rest of their lives, they worried about a depression, having another economic crash, another depression. Now they talk about democracy all the time, as if that's going to solve everything. If we just, every country becomes democratic. And yet no matter how democratic you are, still the problems have not been resolved. In the basic delusion still operate. And within idealism and wanting things to be other than what they are, not wanting things to be the way they are, wanting something you don't have, is, it's an endless trap. The sticky web, the desire realm. one of the problems of being human is hubris. You know, that we, you know, the human individuals can assume they're all powerful. You know, so this is, you know, the idea of hubris is this sense of inflation of one's power. I'm God, I know everything. And I know exactly what you all need, and I, you know, promoting myself, which is called inflating oneself into the ultimate position. And of course, this always leads, and you read Greek tragedies or Sophocles or even modern stories like Hitler and all these dictators within our memory. It was the experience of hubris, of proclaiming oneself as the savior of the world, or the Messiah, or the Maitreya, or God, or, you know, the know-all leader. And then, of course, people get very intimidated, believe, disbelieve, react. War takes place, destruction. Now we all can, you know, there's a certain level of that in all of us, thinking, I know best, or the conceit of culture, like European culture, you know, assumed back in, before the First World War, that the Christian Western world assumed that it was somehow progressive and superior to the rest. You know, so you have colonies, colonize Asia, Africa, islands in the Pacific, North and South America, all like this. I mean, this idea we're bringing civilization. You know, this is a conceit, isn't it? That our civilization, what our view, our opinion is somehow more advanced than somebody else's. And of course, there's certain, you know, if you're totally convinced of that delusion, it gives you a certain power over others. Like a demagogue or a tyrant, you know, just through assuming authority and coming from that position of knowing everything intimidates people. They tend to, because, you know, it's we don't tend to think like that, think of ourselves as gods that know it all. One of the problems, isn't it, the third fetter is doubt, vichikicca, which is, you know, when we think and we doubt ourselves. We can be skeptical or uncertain, insecure. Feeling of insecurity and uncertainty in our lives. So we'll align ourselves maybe with those who seem to be totally confident. You know, I know I'm the way, you follow me. And then because we feel insecure, then we can easily go along with somebody that seems to know all the answers and tell us what to do. So notice in this, the born, the created, the formed condition is basically, I'm God, I know everything, I know how to, if you follow me, you'll be saved, and the whole world would be much better if everybody does what I want, is, you know, the Sakya Ditti carried to the very extremity of insanity. It's totally outside the realm of even acceptable behavior. Beyond the bounds of acceptable human aspiration, isn't it, where I proclaim myself as superior to everyone else. Or we can go to the other. You know, there's a certain security in believing I'm totally hopeless, failure, no good. You know, being a homeless tramp somehow has a certain appeal even to me, because then you don't have to, you know, you're kind of settled for the bottom rather than have, you know, if you place yourself always at the top of the pile, then you have a lot to live up to, and there's somebody always kind of trying to kill you or challenge you or put you down. But if you're at the bottom, then of course people just want to leave you alone, not even know you. So there's a certain security in being like a tramp. And I've worked when I was in university, I used to work weekends at the charity hospital in Seattle. They'd bring in these tramps, you know, that were found, you know, were on the streets. They'd bring them to the charity hospital, and I'd have to clean them up. And of course, at first I was quite repelled, because, you know, they stink, and they're kind of the kind of people you don't, you know, you've spent your life avoiding. And suddenly, here I am in charge of them, taking these wretched men, having to bathe them, sterilize all their clothes because they've got lice and whatnot. And they're thinking, you know, the thought of it really revolted me. But then in the actual work, you know, when you start talking and getting to know some of these people, you realize that they've deliberately chosen such a life. Because they could also see the competitiveness, the ego involvement, the horridness of American competitive existence for men, of just this endless competition and drive. And the kind of futility of it, so they just wouldn't participate and live the other way. Dropouts. Now we kind of praise the kind of successful ones, you know, the ones at the top, the chief executive officer, the president, prime minister, the ones who really make something of themselves, and we despise the dropouts. So this is, but this is all conditioning, you know, whether you're a total failure, a dropout, hated by the society, resented or despised, or, you know, you're the most successful human individual in the whole world. It's still the sticky web of conditioning. So then, there is the unborn, the unoriginated, uncreated, unformed. That's a statement, isn't it? It's not a philosophical concept, like, I believe there's, you know, something like the unoriginated, unformed. It's, you know, I like to take it quite literally, there is ati. This Pali word atti, there is, bhikkhus, the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unoriginated. And because there is the unborn, unoriginated, the uncreated, unformed, there is escape from the born, the originated, the created, the forms. So this is quite a, you know, this gives us a possibility of getting off this web, not through destroying anything, but transcending it, no longer being bound, conditioned, trapped with the identities on the sticky web of conditioning, the samsara. We're not destroying it or rejecting it, But we're no longer stuck on it either. We're no longer bound into it, programmed, lost in it, deluded by it. And so that is the, there is the unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unformed. Now then you apply that to the here and now, Pachubana Dhamma. Because those are just words, and they can be inspiring or give us hope or faith. But then it's not about, you know, just reciting it in Pali and translating it into English or thinking about it. Then reflectiveness is actually, what is it right now? Pachubana Dhamma. If there is the unborn, uncreated, unoriginated, unformed, what is it? You know, it has to be here and now. It can't be something somewhere else or some other time. It can't be about the future of when I get my samadhi together, then I'll get it. Or I'm practicing now with all these, you know, with these kilesas, these defilements, with these bad habits, with my personality and my problems, in order to resolve them sometime in the future. And then maybe I will understand and recognize the unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unformed. That is Sakkaya Ditti, isn't it? That's the self view. So that's why it is it's subtle. It's almost abrupt. It's like, well, wake up here and now. Pay attention. The unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unformed. Now when you stop thinking and stop, you know, stop trying to control your mind and try to get something you don't have and get rid of something you have, when you have that shock, maybe, like a shock, suddenly your thinking mind stops. And you're suspended in the state of just attentiveness, pure awareness. You know, so then mindfulness is recognizing this. Now we can't just go around expecting shocks to do it for us. There's a limitation on just seeing that I need to be shocked all the time in order to recognize. So out of compassion, the Buddha, you know, gave some very skillful means, like the Dhamma teachings, to reflect and investigate and remind, to, you know, therefore, they're very practical teachings. They're not airy-fairy philosophical, metaphysical ideals. So, like, the intuitive awareness, Sati Sampajanya, this is consciousness, and it's consciousness pure. Consciousness operating, it has a continuity, it's not a momentary thing. It's like it's here all the time, and then whatever we put into it, out of ignorance of each other, then we, you know, I create myself, my views, opinions. I create you. You know, so memory, we have the memories and retentive memories. So we remember and we have names for each other. We have views, personal opinions, personal attitudes, tendencies, biases that we fully committed to out of ignorance, to what I think and my view, or my I'm right, the sense of being right, or maybe being so uncertain of yourself that you believe somebody else who says they're right. You say, Ajahn Sumedho's right, so I'll believe and go along with him. So then you know, you're not really observing what you're doing. You're being caught onto the sticky web in a way that there's no way out of it other than, you know, you'd just be stuck there. For how many more lifetimes have we all been on this web, this complicated, sticky death realm of beginning and endings, birth and death? So in this lifetime, within this incarnation of the human, of your own human body, you know, this is the chance of a lifetime, or maybe many lifetimes, to break out of it, to see it, to learn, to be able to free yourself from delusion of this blind commitment, helpless, powerful, samsaric conditioning, this sticky web that no matter how hard you try to pull yourself out of it through ignorance, you get even more stuck into it, more lost and deluded by it. So then there is the unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unformed. Mindfulness, the path, the way. And then mindfulness is the simplicity, ultimate simplicity of pure conscious attention, awareness here and now. Now consciousness is expansive, it has no boundary. But the boundaries we create in consciousness are, you know, me and mine, the conventions we have, the identities that we, you know, what we think we are, our beliefs, our doubts, our fears. So in the, like the five khandhas, the rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana, the six senses, the ayatanas, consciousness through the senses, through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. So consciousness, we're sensory, when we experience life through the senses, through the body, then that's all we know. We see it always in the limitation of pleasure, pain, me and mine. But because we can be aware of sense consciousness, we can observe, we can be the knower of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, feeling. You know, if we couldn't do that, then there'd be no hope. We're just helpless victims of our conditions. We just, you know, if we get good conditions in the past or terrible ones, we're the victims of it. Of what happens, of the past, of what others say and do, of the societies and that we live in. We're just helplessly lost and victims of unfairness, injustice, wars, violence. So But because there is the unborn uncreated, then there is an escape. And that, of course, the Buddha, this mindfulness, sati, sampajanya, panya discerning. And so the simplicity of discernment, of knowing the conditions. And that's what, you know, on this retreat I've been trying to emphasize, trust yourself in knowing conditions. You know, knowing, feeling is feeling, seeing is seeing, hearing is hearing, smelling is smelling, tasting is tasting, thinking is thinking, knowing is like this. So that there's this knowing of conditions, and the five khandhas, the sensory consciousness, and the experience of feeling and pleasure, pain, beauty and ugliness, of neutrality, because we can be aware of whether, you know, whether the present moment is pleasant, neutral, or unpleasant. This knowing then, the consciousness with wisdom, discerning, knowing when there's hatred and when there isn't any. Discerning hatred or dosa is like this. And when in this way you're not judging it nor indulging or suppressing, you're just recognizing hatred, dosa is like this. And if you're patient with a rising of anger in your mind, if you allow it, you know, neither act or speak on it, then it ceases. And then there's discernment of adosa, non-angers like this. This is discernment, this is panya. Panya is not about good and bad, right and wrong. There's a kind of worldly wisdom on that level, you know, so lokutra panya is, you know, knowing to do good, refrain from doing bad, to discriminate, to know that the result of doing good things and doing bad things, you know, so there's a level of worldly wisdom. But Lokya-panya, rather, is about the world. Lokutra-panya is discerning the unborn, knowing the unborn by no longer blindly being deluded by the born or the created. So then, you know, apply that to the present moment, right now, each one of you. So then you're knowing that right now this pure reflective conscious awareness, like at this moment observing from this point here, there's no anger. Just observing, there's no anger in consciousness at this time. I'm watching, there's watching, knowing. So this is adosa, non-anger, it's like this. noticing it, you know, affirming it, so that you recognize consciousness. Consciousness knows itself, is reflective. No greed, no hatred, no delusions like this. Now when I do this, of course I notice this sound of silence. It has this stream-like, it's not a dead kind of, you know, kind of blackout. It's fully, for his full attention, alertness, where, and from this, of course, conditions arise and cease. So it's not annihilating conditions, or annihilating greed, hatred, and delusion, or trying to get rid of your sakyaditti, or your personality, or your ego. It's not trying to completely destroy your social, cultural conditioning, or an attack on thinking. You've got to annihilate thinking, discrimination. It's not that, but it puts that ability to discriminate, to judge, in a relationship that you can, you know, that you can operate with it. You can develop it, cultivate a way of living your life out of wisdom, rather than out of just habit, prejudice, biases, fixed views, fears, and desire. So from this, then the Vinaya is a convention for living one's life in the human form that is, you know, if used properly, is a way of living in the world out of compassion. So then, you know, in the Eightfold Path, there's the, you know, after the insights of the first three noble truths, suffering has been realized, there are the causes of suffering, and the to be let go of, letting go has been, you know, has been accomplished. There is the end of dukkha. This is recognized now, end of dukkha. It's always here in the jitta, isn't it? The end, the beginning, the ending, and the observing of beginning and ending. And then there's right samaditi, samasangapo, which is perfect understanding. And this is perfect understanding, and following this sequence. This isn't just right understanding in terms of lokiya, of the worldly wisdom. This is perfect. This is complete and perfect understanding, enlightenment, in other words. Samaditi, samasangapo, and that, you know, inclines us toward how we live our lives in the lifespan that we have within this form, toward sammāvācā, sammāgamanto, sammāchīvo, right speech, right action, right livelihood. So in the use of vinaya, then sammāvācā, sammāgamanto, sammāchīvo is perfected if lived in the right way. You know, if we identify cling to Vinaya and the structures of Vinaya and identify ourselves with always out of ignorance and sakyaditi with the Vinaya, then of course we've missed the point. It's not for clinging, for attachment, for ignorance. It's for mindfulness. That's the whole point of Vinaya. It's for awareness, not for attachment, identity, personal positioning. So Samavaja, you know, this is being able to speak, to say, to use our voice, you know, how we relate through speech to the world around us, to the society we're in. So it's a, you know, from Samadhi, perfect understanding, perfect intention, then perfect speech, perfect action, perfect livelihood. So then it's alms mendicants, it's perfect livelihood. Gamanto sama, gamanto sama achivo. You know, how we relate to the society, to living here in England, for example. In this society, in this country, is not to cause it problems, be divisive, be judgmental, you know, promote certain political views and create forces against, for and against, but to, for sama waja, sama gamanto, sama achivo, is live in this style of the samana, alms mendicant, that has so much faith, so much confidence in the goodness of humanity that we're willing to put ourselves on the edge as depending for the basic necessities for survival, depending on that through our wisdom, through our cultivation of this way, that these basic necessities, the supports that are necessary for just physical survival, will be provided. So in that way, we you know, our presence in this country is not to just take advantage of a system or use it or to, you know, convert it or cause more religious divisions or problems or angst or difficulties to this country. It has enough without us adding to it. But so there's some right action, right, gamanto sama achivo, right livelihood. So in this way, you know, see that as we live, fulfill our position in society is samanas. Those who are content with little, not greedy, not caught in the competitiveness and the views and the present day opinions and ideals and that of modern British society, we're not condemning it either. We're not judging it. But how we live in this society isn't through, you know, through personal preferences or views, but through compassion, through metta, karuna, mudita, upeka, the Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes. And then, of course, some Vayamo Samasati Samasamadhi, perfect effort, perfect mindfulness, perfect concentration. So that is the, you know, this equanimity, upekha. There's this sense of stillness, awareness, stillness, are not just emotional cripples anymore, going up and down according to, you know, the worldly dhammas. You know, when we're personalities, then we're emotionally charged all the time. Praise and blame, success, failure, good fortune, bad fortune, good health, bad health. Our happiness depends on being praised and being successful and being happy. And then our misery is through feeling a failure or being blamed or criticized or rejected, having illnesses, sicknesses, being looked down on. That's, you know, so the eight worldly dhammas. And then there's Lokuttara, transcending these eight worldly dhammas, is the knower of them, not the one who identifies and is deluded by these eight worldly dhammas. Now, the knower of the eight worldly dhammas is not any of the eight worldly dhammas. That's the unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unformed. Then the Sakkayaditti, the first three fetters to stream entry, is, you know, this is the world, this is the conditioning process, this is how I see myself. Me and mine, what I think, my position, my role. So as a senior monk, as a patriarchal old Mahatera, as an upachaya, a preceptor, all these things, all these, you know, as someone who's the big cheese, maybe, or the boss. You know, how many of you see me in those perceptions? Big father, authoritarian figure. That's not how I see myself, actually, on a Sakkayaditti level. I don't see myself through those kind of perceptions. But, I mean, I get feedback where sometimes people see me through that, because that's the conditioning process. You know, the size, the gender, the position, the power, all this is personified and then reacted to. But that which is aware of what your reactions are, you know, I can't kind of command you to feel a certain way. Say, you should respect me. You know, then I become like a nagging person, you know, that you should respect your elders and you should be grateful for all I've done for you. And then I go on a tirade of all the things I've done here and for you, and I expect gratitude and respect for that. And that is, you know, that's a tyrant, isn't it? That's a nagging, intimidating tyrant. That's Sakkayaditti. Or to go the other way, I'm just humble, just like you. I don't hold myself as being special. I'm just an ordinary guy. That's the American view. Americans, we always want to bring everybody into the most familiar positions. Like you go to the States and they find it difficult, you know, someone like myself, because I am an American, and they say, Ajahn Sumedho sounds so stiff and formal. I go to Thailand and I can be called Tanjau Kun Rat Sumeta Chariya. And it goes even on further, but I forget the whole title. But in America, that would be ridiculous. You know, go home, tempt my sister to say, Tanjau Kun Raja Sumeta Chariya. So inevitably, they want to call you Bob, which is a name I loathe. And then one old friend, you know, wants to say, old pal, old buddy to me all the time, you know, like we used to be. That's the American, isn't it? You old, my old buddy, my old pal. In England, they're a little more respectful. They don't quite sink that low. But Americans, you know, they want to call me Sumeto, or no, that's even that too formal. Maybe Sue. And there's a great country and western song about, what is it? This rough cowboy that was embarrassed because his mother named him Sue. But these are cultural differences, isn't it? Like Thailand has a Buddhist, you know, Buddhism is so integrated into its culture that this deference, these titles, these things are a part of a cultural thing, so they're not embarrassing or out of place or affected, you know, kind of titles that sound silly in a context, say, like the United States. But also to want to go into the old buddy palsy-walsy place is not appropriate either. I mean, we're samanas now. The samana, you know, is right action, right speech, right action, right livelihood. And so we're not demanding respect or people to treat us as if we were high-ranking priests or anything. We're mendicants. We depend on the kindness and goodness of others for our survival. So our relationship to the society is not demanding or putting ourselves in a kind of positioning of a priesthood or a, you know, a kind of Brahmin caste or anything like that. So remind yourself, you're like a beggar. You're a mendicant. You're not an important person, a great master, a meditation teacher, an inspiring example to the world or anything like this. It's not, you know, coming from these elevated positions that oftentimes we're placed in by the society. You know, so the society raises up and say, Tanjau Kun Raja Sumeta Charya is a great meditation master. I don't operate from that perception. That's, people may put that perception onto me. But my reflection is a samana, alms mendicant, bhikkhu. And if I see myself operating from this, I'm the great meditation master position, you know, I can recognize it. I know it for what it is. And I don't, you know, I don't want to hold on to such a perception of myself as being a great meditation master or a highly regarded senior monk of great, you know, significance in the Buddhist world, things like this. That's not a perception I want to perpetuate or operate from, because I can see that it would be just deluding myself. Sakya ditti operates, takes me over. So in this position of the alms mendicant is, you know, is right speech, then right speech, samma vaja, samma gamanto, samma chivo, can operate from there, not from being an important person or a famous figure or a special person, special being. So in this sense, we're all something like the ordained sangha, the bhikkhu sangha, siladhara, the samanas. You're putting yourself on the edge of depending on the goodness of others for your survival. Now that is a great sacrifice when you think of it. You're letting go of a lot of what we're culturally conditioned to not do, to not trust. Not put yourself on the edge, but to demand security and rights and privileges and all kinds of things from this country, from society. But this samana position is, it's worthy of respect because it's trusting in the goodness of the society we're living in. We're, you know, taking the samana precepts here in England, for example, is an act of trust, isn't it? That you're trusting that the people in this country, that by this simple act of renunciation and your determination for liberation from delusion, then that's your position in the society is one of right action, right livelihood. You're bringing into the consciousness, by example, of relinquishing, non-pride, non-arrogance, non-conceit, non-divisiveness, just a nobody, not a great person, a personality. Or being, trying to intimidate all the rest of the people. They should be just like you. You know, I could be an arrogant samana. You know, you should all be like me. And humble like I am. I'm the living example of complete, honest humility. And of course that's ridiculous, isn't it? It's not being anything. Being this knowing, this unborn, uncreated, unformed. Being this awareness. So it's not like you have to find out who you are. You're just recognizing, realizing what you're not. You're not any of the things you think, or the physical bodies you have, or the position you're in. You're not even a monk or a nun, or an anagarika, or a layperson. These are conditions, they are what they are, you know. So we have tall monks and short monks, senior monks, junior monks, nuns, tall nuns, short nuns. European nuns, Asian nuns. These are just the discrimination of the conditioned realm. Because we live together in a community, then the Vinaya is how we, the agreements we have on duties, responsibilities that we accept within the structure of the traditional Vinaya. So this is the challenge we all face, you know, and if you're willing to do it, then you can root out this basic ignorance, kind of extirpate delusion, let go of the conditions that create the illusions in order to abide in the pure, unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned, which is ultimate reality, which is truth, which is Dhamma.
Yeah.